off of him now. Listen.
Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Now here's your host, DeAndrew.
And welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight my guest will be New England MUFON director, Steve Fermi. But before we get started, I have a brief announcement that I would like to do before I introduce my guest. I was invited by my friend, Skylar Alfagren, to become the Arizona LOFI Bureau Chief. LOFI stands for League of Western Fortean Intermediatists. It is my hope that I can keep you informed on all things Fortean in Arizona. And so come with me, and together we'll travel the road to the strange Fortean world we live in. The website for that is www.fortianswest.com. My brief, tangled tongue tonight. Ah, gosh. My guest this week, Steve Fermi, is the New England State Director for MUFON, which encompasses the following states: Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont. Steve is a certified field investigator, and Mr. Fermi attended this year's MUFON Symposium in Denver, Colorado, and he will be speaking at the upcoming 2010 Exeter UFO Festival. The topic of his lecture will be New England's Pandora, a review of selected cases from New England's MUFON Pandora Project files. I am very pleased and honored to welcome my guest tonight, Mr. Steve Fermi. Steve, you cover such a big area. It must keep you awful, awful busy.
well, it does. Thank you for having me on. It does. It takes a lot of work, but you have, in order to do a lot, you have to have people that that are supportive, and we have many people like that in New England.
Well, one of the questions I ask most of my guests is, what got you started on the topic of ufology?
Oh, that happened back in when I was in grade school. I was in grade school. There were two of my classmates. They were more of the nerdy type, as you'd call it, that were pretty much put down a lot by the other classmates. And I was probably kind of that way myself. And they came in. They used to hang out together a lot. And they came in one day to class and told people that they'd seen a flying saucer. And they were ridiculed, put down by everyone else in the school and the class. And I just didn't like that. So my first trip was I went to the public library and I opened up a book by J. Allen Hynek. And that got me going.
Sounds a lot like how I got started.
Mm-hmm.
Again, grade school, looking through the library for something to read, and got a hold of Frank Edwards' Flying Saucer, Serious Business.
Oh, I have that book, and it's addicting. Once you get into it, it's addicting.
Very. Tell us about this Pandora Project.
Okay, well, with the Pandora Project, it's simply we have a CMS, the MUFON Case Management System, which is the automated system that accepts UFO reports online. What the Pandora Project was, it was the former international director, James Carrion. It was a project he was working on to put on disk of the pre-case management system files, all of the old paper files from MUFON. I was lucky enough that last year, not this year, last year's symposium in Denver, I was lucky enough to be presented by James a copy of each of my six states' Pandora files. So there are a lot of cases that you probably don't hear much about, or don't even, a lot of people don't even know about. And that's what I'll be covering in my talk and et cetera.
Can you give us a hint to some of these stories?
Well, I'm in the process of going through things. I just got back from Denver. I would really love to. I'm just going on memory now. And the last time I reviewed some of these files, that there was a rash, I think it was in Maine, of sonic boom, where there was no traffic. This was like over a period of days where people were hearing sonic booms all over that area, and they couldn't explain why it happened. There were newspaper articles out on this incident, and it's a pretty strange event.
I got a little bit of static. I didn't hear what year that was.
I'm not sure. This was all, like I said, all pre case management, so it has to have gone back to like into either the 60s or the 50s or the 50s and earlier.
Oh, wow. That kind of reminded me of back in the late 70s when they were talking about all the sonic booms that were being heard all up and down the East Coast.
Exactly.
And then later on we found out it was the SR-71 Blackbird. At least that's what they say.
Mm-hmm. Which is the possibility that was what caused this also.
Interesting. I was noticing on your site, too, that you have a link to an interesting latest UFO reports, I guess you could call it, maps.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a really interesting and really fun idea on how to get the word out on these different reports from all over the United States, not just New England.
Mm-hmm. That's also where that originates. That is on the National MUFON website.
Okay. I've got your website up here. I thought that was really good the way that map was put together. And you were speaking at the MUFON symposium here recently. How did that go?
I did attend. I wasn't actually a speaker, but I did attend. It was a I think overall, with our state directors' meetings, that MUFON is on the forefront of really making some things happen. I think MUFON in the past has been accused of keeping things to themselves and not giving a lot of information to the public. A lot of that will change because within the next week or so, MUFON is going to be establishing a brand new website. It's going to be informative. There's going to be information for the public on that website. And they're also launching a thing called MUFON Radio. So they will actually be launching a radio channel.
Oh, wonderful.
So things are starting to happen. I think that the state directives came out of our state directives meeting with a feeling of that accomplishment, and that things are really going to start to happen with MUFON this year.
Oh, interesting! I can't wait to see the new website. See how it looks.
Be out within the week.
Okay, I'm being told that people have some difficulty hearing you speak. If you get just a little closer to the phone, that might help out.
Is that any better?
Just a little louder, please.
Okay, well, let me try something different here. Hold on. Is this better?
Oh, much better. Yeah.
Okay, I was speaking with that earpiece and a headset.
Oh, okay. Sometimes that happens.
Yeah.
What was now I've got myself all messed up here. On the symposium, there was, excuse me, quite a lineup of speakers. I've heard quite a few of these individuals speak and a few that I haven't.
Mm-hmm.
But the list is impressive. There was Bud Hopkins, Rich Dolan, Kathleen Martin, Don Schmidt, Kevin Randall, Nick Redfern, Mark D'Antonio, Michael Stratt, George Filer, John Greenwald, Linda Moulton Howe, and John Burroughs.
It was a large group. Unfortunately, Bud Hopkins was not able to speak, as his health hasn't been very good lately. So they had to replace him as speaker. Mark D'Antonio is, I don't know if you've ever talked to Mark, if you know who he is. He's the MUFON photo and video analyst.
Yes.
He runs an organization out in Connecticut that creates models and model effects, and he's a former astronomer for the Navy. So he has a lot of talent and a lot of things. Most of his speaking engagements are on trainings, things such as photo analysis. And I have learned so much from Mark about analyzing photographs and videos. It's amazing.
Well, actually, I saw him on that UFOs Over Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Doing some work in on that, and I was impressed with it.
Oh, Mark is—he really knows what he's doing. You know, I don't know what I'd do without him sometimes. Because it's not easy analyzing photographs. But there is one kind of humorous photograph that Mark showed us during one of the trainings. It showed this showed a normal photograph. Person submitted it as a UFO case. Showed a normal photograph, but it looked like this little object in the top left corner of the photograph. And Mark looked at it. He was trying to figure out what it was. And all of a sudden, he goes, slaps himself in the head. He asked the person. He said, "Did you take this photograph and load it on, or did you scan it?" They said they scanned it. What happened was the person inadvertently stapled the corner of the photograph, and when they scanned it, the staple was on the corner, and that's what created the image of a UFO. I thought that was quite humorous.
Oh my! Oh, oh, jeez! Oh, I guess that would be something to confuse a person, wouldn't it?
Oh, it was. It was funny.
Oh, okay. Well, we have a question already from our virtual auditorium, and this one is from Cartoonist. He says, "Hi, Steve. My question is, New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, etc., got together to form New England MUFON. Do you think the rest of the country will follow suit with groups like Northwest MUFON, Southeast MUFON, etc.?"
I really don't think it's necessary. It was necessary at this time in New England, where some of the areas are so remote from each other, if you don't have a certain director in each of the states, it's difficult to keep everyone together and to band together. So I just think it was, I felt it was necessary at that time, and I suggested it to James Carrion at when he was international director, and that was accepted, and it just took off from there.
Oh, interesting. You know, I got to think, and gosh, five states, that's a lot of territory to cover.
Six states.
Must keep you hopping.
Oh, it does. It does. Plus, I work a full-time job also.
I know that feeling. On some of these cases that you've gone and investigated, what one was the most intriguing to you?
Oh, that's easy. This past April in Laconia, New Hampshire, we had a case of a car levitation by a UFO.
Wow.
Exactly, yeah. It was an interesting, very interesting case. We have physical evidence involved. What happened was there were two in Laconia, New Hampshire, up in the lakes area. There were two teenagers. They were out in a parking lot around 11:15 at night, and they noticed an object pass in front of the moon. Then it went back to the right, and then it went back to the left again, and then it started coming towards their car. According to them, when the thing got closer, when the object got closer, the windshield shattered in their car. They got nervous and decided that they needed to get out of there, get out of that parking lot. But their only recourse was to take a right and then take a left. And when they took that left, in order to get out of the parking lot, they had to go right back in the direction of the object that was coming at them. The object was lifted. According to the witnesses, the car was lifted about 4 feet off the ground. The male who was driving noticed he looked and saw that the girl was being pulled out of the window of the car by some force. His arm was being pulled out of the driver's side by some force. As he struggled, his arm hit the horn. When the horn sounded, it released somewhat. But then it started up again, and then the same thing happened. He struggled again, and his arm hit the horn, and that's when the car dropped.
And I bet they got out of there real quick.
They did, because it happened around 11:15. By about 12:15, they were at home. They came. Their mother, the mother said that they were both screaming and panicking. So she called the police, and the police became involved. What did happen was, when they initially, so we did receive a copy of the police report. The police report states a different location for where it happened, and there was a reason for that. That they didn't want the parents to know that they were parking. That's why they were in the parking lot. So the police actually went to the wrong location to investigate. But upon our investigation, we did find that there was damage to an area. If you know what a parking lot is like, they have the separator islands that have the asphalt rims
mm-hmm.
on the separators. Well, there was significant. There was like about three deep gouges in the asphalt rim, and there were a couple tire tracks across some of the dirt on the separator. We found that, and I was able to acquire from the body shop after the car was repaired. I was able to acquire the front frame of the car, and underneath the frame, I found what seemed to be a yellow substance. So I collected the substance. But what came to my mind was that this substance was possibly paint. It looked like paint, and I could not remember for the life of me what color the separator lines for the parking spaces were in that parking lot. So I went back up. It's a 2-hour drive one way. I went back up there, and I brought the frame, and I matched it up with the three gouges, and it matched perfectly.
Oh, wow.
Also, I collected samples from one of the separator lines in the parking lot, and paint matched perfectly on both. So I can place that vehicle in that parking lot, that something did happen that evening.
What kind of examination was done on the car?
We did radiation checks, electromagnetic, anything you can possibly do to detect any abnormalities. What happened with the vehicle was, after the windshield had shattered, there was also the airbags were deployed, and the undercarriage, there was over $4,000 to $5,000 damage to the undercarriage of the vehicle. The airbag, take a note that the airbags were deployed, but there was no evidence of a collision on any part of the frame or the body of the car.
So the jolt of it dropping initiated the airbags.
Exactly. The airbag control module was inoperable. If you know, when you click your seatbelt into the seatbelt holder, there's a sensor that tells you whether your seatbelt's plugged in or not. That was fried. So all of this equipment was inoperable from the vehicle just from this one incident.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard of that happening before. Gosh, that's intriguing.
Mm-hmm. And we did the interviews, and it would seem to me, within the time that this happened at 11:15 p.m. and the police showed up, it would have been pretty much impossible for these two kids to have made up the story and made it so convincing, both from when interviewed separately. It just seems impossible. It was a pretty elaborate story.
I agree. In New York, Lily, in our virtual auditorium here in Pal Talk, put in an interesting comment saying, try explaining that to the insurance company.
Well, that was an interesting thing, too. They did submit the information, and it was covered. It really wasn't MUFON's business as to how they were going to file their claim. MUFON doesn't get involved in legal activities or insurance claims. It's we're just there to investigate the facts of the incident.
another humorous comment in the auditorium. Are aliens covered under acts of God in an insurance policy? To tell you the truth, I don't know.
that one I couldn't answer either.
That's interesting. Ah, gosh, I bet those kids were scared to death when they finally got to, either her folks' home or his parents.
Well, they,
or,
they, they did seem to be, the police and the mother said that they were quite hysterical.
I think I would be, too, after an incident such as that.
I think anyone would be. It's so surreal.
Do you get a lot of reports for the all six states that you represent?
Well, currently we have, and it's probably because I'm looking for investigators, I'm looking for members. I could use a lot more investigators in each of my six states, and it's not, you don't have to be a scientist to become an investigator. All you have to do is be diligent in what you do. We have a field investigator's manual that can be purchased, and there's an exam that you pass. And once you pass that, you work with other investigators. I've been doing this for 30 years. I wasn't really an Einstein when I started off, and I've gotten to where I am.
A couple of people in our virtual auditorium have posted almost the same question, but New York Lily and Gossamer have both asked if either of those two kids had had any other encounters before.
No, they hadn't.
Okay.
None but the boy's mother had had an experience when she was a young girl, when she was in Greece.
Oh, really? An international one, then?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's interesting. Have you ever had a case that just totally baffled you, you know, that just had you sitting on the fence on whether or not you thought it was, extraterrestrial related or something mundane or a hoax?
I think the ones that baffle me the most people send me in these photographs, and they claim that the photographs show an alien, and I look at the photographs, and to me it looks like a reflection off of maybe a marble gravestone or something in the cemetery with the photographs taken, and I'm thinking to myself, why would an alien be hanging around a cemetery? That's what baffles me.
I
that's
agree.
What baffles me.
it sounds like somebody was watching Plan 9 from outer space.
Well, what did happen was when I interviewed the person further, they told me that they had gone to see their, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with psychics, and but they went to see a certain psychic, and the person told them that they would see aliens. And I explained to them, I said, if you're expecting to see something, you can see things in a lot of different things. All over the place. If somebody plants that in your mind, that's what you're going to see. That's what you're going to think everything is.
Oh, that's very true. That's very true. Suggestion can be a powerful thing.
Mm-hmm.
I have another question from our virtual auditorium. This one's from Cartoonist, and he asks, how much spare time does a person need to give in order to be a reliable field investigator?
How much what was that? I didn't...
How much spare time does a person need to give in order to be a reliable field investigator?
Being a field investigator is a bit of a part-time job in itself. What we're looking for people with ample time and that want to put the effort into doing things, as we did in the Laconia case. It takes time, And it takes a lot of effort if people aren't willing to put the time and effort into it. Then they probably would not make a good investigator.
True, and then when you got to consider too that the investigator has to pay all their own expenses as well.
It is, but the fact is though, if we can get enough investigators in each area, it would be cost-effective for all our investigators to only have to investigate cases within a close range, because most of the expenses for an investigator is probably travel.
Oh, here's a good question. This one's from my husband, David, mm-hmm. And he asks, do you think people are targeting MUFON and other groups with hoaxed photos and videos, etc., more than in the past to try and put one over on such investigative organizations?
I don't think it's increased or decreased. I feel that it's always been the same.
Yes, I've seen some stuff online that you look at it and you go, and this is supposed to be a UFO?
I know. A lot of the photographs, they just look like a lot of the photographs that we get. We can't say they're a UFO. We can't say they're not a UFO, but they're inconclusive. They're so blurry. It could be a bird. It could be anything.
Good old blurfos. Yes. Yes. I've seen a lot of that. The ones that get me the most are just the nondescript lights in the sky in photographs and videos that show nothing but the sky. I mean, there's nothing in there to show relation to distance and size and altitude or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. There were so many possibilities of what someone could be seeing in the night sky. You know, intrigues me so much is that people send us so many reports that they say I saw a fireball in the sky. Right? It's basically what it is, fireball media.
Good old bullseye.
Exactly. Well, actually, there's a difference between a bolide and a fireball media. A fireball media, it really doesn't make a sound as it goes across, travels fairly quickly, can be any color, just as a bolide. But what a bolide is at the end of its trajectory, it breaks apart and explodes. That's when you get a boom, like a sonic boom sound. That's the difference between a bolide and a fireball media.
Oh, I didn't know there was a difference. Thank you for setting that straight. Appreciate it. Gosh, we're going quicker than I had planned on. Because I'm kind of wanting to save the Exeter conference till the second hour, and we're going so fast, I don't know where to turn to next.
Well, let's slow down. There's plenty we can... that we can talk about.
Here's another question from our virtual auditorium, if you'd like.
Mm-hmm.
This one's from Eternal Being. Hi, EB. He asks, is there a criteria that defines when a report is worth considering or is considered to have values which place it in a context worthy of investigation?
Well, as an experienced investigator of close to 30 years, you just know by looking at it. I've investigated so many cases that you can, I think, the most common explanation of astronomical objects, lights in the sky, I think that can be, and there's pretty simple ways of doing it. As an experienced investigator, what you do is right from the start, when you see a case, automatically, in your head, you're coming up with a hypothesis on what it possibly could be, so you know which possibilities to check. And that's pretty much how it's done. So as an investigator with experience, you pretty much know right away what you're looking for.
Interesting. You had something else that you said you would like to talk about.
My friend Peter Robbins has an interesting book, and you probably discussed it with him, Left at Eastgate.
Oh, yes, I have actually several copies.
he's done a fantastic job, and Kathy Martin and Stan Friedman have their publication out, Science Was Wrong. We have an interesting amount. You said you have been on the website. I was fortunate enough to have Stan and Kathy do a little 30-minute blurb each to be posted on the website to promote the Exeter Conference. So that was pretty nice also.
Cool. Well, that's Peter. He's just wonderful. He's always willing and ready to go help promote the different conferences, and that's something I can appreciate. I try to do that myself.
Oh, well, we also have something brand new that we just formed. Myself and one of my we have a young member of MUFON who's under the age of 18. He's an auxiliary member. We formed on Facebook. We formed the MUFON Youth Group.
Oh yes, I'm working on getting him on my program as well. He sounds like an interesting individual.
Oh, he is. He is Tyler Delia.
Yes.
Yes. He's doing a fantastic job. And when I spoke with Peter last Thursday, we were looking into the possibility of setting something up like for youth groups across the country, if they would like to have someone like Peter or myself as a guest at their youth group meeting through Skype, that we would be willing to do that.
Oh, how wonderful.
And set it up anywhere so that we could actually attend meetings and speak on Skype at anywhere in the country, anywhere in the world for the kids.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's so nice of you and Peter and everyone to do that. That's great.
That was Peter's idea, but we just discussed last Thursday. I thought it was an excellent suggestion to make this work.
Oh, well, Peter is the dedicated, consummate UFO man.
he is, definitely.
Okay, we have another question from our virtual auditorium. And this one's from Rixio, and he asks, does MUFON do more than investigate sightings and publish results? For instance, is there a MUFON program aimed at public education? Is there any kind of program dedicated to figuring out what it all means?
Let's start from the last question. It would be fairly difficult to sit down, and it would be only speculation to try and figure out what it all means. That we don't know what it all means at this point. However, the purpose of MUFON is to collect UFO sightings, to put it in our database, and to educate the public. That is what events like the Exeter Festival, the MUFON Symposium, that's why they're open to the public, for education of the public, and that's why we're running the MUFON Youth Group. I also have a New England MUFON Facebook page out there also.
Interesting. I just had a question in my head and lost it.
That happens.
I forget when that happened. Oh, I remember. With the festival or the conference you've got coming up in Exeter, and you have the UFO Festival in law as well. You have one going in, there's one going in McMinnville, Oregon. You know, all these different little cities that have had some kind of a UFO tie-in in its history. Looking too much into the past at the historic sites or sightings, is that, are you seeing that happening a lot, or is it just bringing up old history, as some people sometimes complain, so to speak, about why dragging up old history?
As you know, the Exeter Conference was built. Last year was its first year, and it was built on the incident at Exeter of the book by John Fuller.
Okay.
But as far as other conferences are built on that besides Roswell, I think most of them are just state run conferences. As a matter of fact, I received a press release from Pennsylvania MUFON joint venture.
Mm-hmm.
They will be having two conferences coming up in October. One will be in Philadelphia on October 9th, and they will have Richard Dolan, Bud Hopkins, if he's feeling well, Bill Burns, John Ventre, Kathy Martin, and Jen Stein, speaking on crop circles. And in Pittsburgh on October 16th, they will be having Stan Gordon and Leslie Keene, Richard Dolan again, Karen Dolan, Jen Stein, Peter will be there, and John Ventre. So, John Ventre does a fantastic job of running conferences up there. He has, two conferences a month. That's a lot.
Wow.
And he does that religiously.
In your work, have you, in your region, let me put it that way, your region, your six-state region, have you identified any hot spots that get a lot of reports sent into you, or are they pretty much scattered out?
I think probably two biggest states as far as reports are probably Massachusetts and Connecticut. It's almost like it happens by population.
That's an interesting observation.
Mm-hmm. Because the smaller states, we do get sightings, and we get steady sightings coming from these states. But if you look at, Vermont and Rhode Island, we don't get as many cases as we do in other states.
Well, Rhode Island's pretty small.
Exactly.
Vermont's not really all that much bigger, though, is it?
It's bigger. It's probably maybe twice the size of Vermont. Rhode Island, I'm sorry. But I think you can correlate the size of a state with the amount of sightings that come in. I think the larger the population, more people are going to be looking up in the sky.
So there's not one specific town or area in those six states that gets a lot of reports?
Not any certain town, no. There might be something that happens where some people might see something a couple nights in a row in a certain town. But mostly if someone sees something, if it's a light in the sky a few nights in a row, it's usually something astronomical. Because they usually report it as being in the same spot of the sky, same location, same time, or a little bit early, a little bit later.
I noticed too on your New England MUFON website that you had links to go where you could go find satellites that are over at specific times in the space station.
There's a site that I subscribe to called spaceweather.com, and you can actually go on to the site and you can either be emailed or text messaged when the International Space Station is going to fly over about 15, 20 minutes before it comes over.
Oh, that's cool.
And we also have, I don't know if you've heard about the X-37B, the government space plane, the Air Force space plane.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the new one.
Yeah, the Air Force has launched it. It looks almost like the space shuttle, but it's a lot smaller. It's orbiting around the Earth right now. It's called the X-37B, and we do get updates on when that's going to fly over from space weather phone also.
Any idea how long that thing's going to be up there?
Well, usually goes up for about 90 days, and then they may launch another one. It would be like if the space shuttle was up there for 90 days, then they'd launch another one.
Wow, this is going to be interesting to see how this program unfolds.
It is, yeah. There's also another interesting item that the Air Force is putting up. It's a small satellite. It's almost like shaped like a cube. This will be probably sometime next year that could cause UFO sightings if they do this. It's like a cube-shaped satellite. And what it does is they launch it, and it's a maintenance satellite. What it will do, it will orbit around an orbiting satellite. And with a camera, it will analyze, see how the outside surface of the satellite is doing, and if it needs any repairs.
Boy, the stuff they're coming up to send up into space.
Exactly. And the more they come up with, the more things that could cause a UFO sighting.
I can to see somebody not knowing about this space plane, because this isn't something, you know, not the average individual walking the streets knows about this thing.
And that's what we're here for. We're here to educate when people report something by us. A lot of people think that we're here debunking. We're not here debunking. We're educating people on what they possibly saw. So it's not, and we're not intending to make it look like we're debunking what a person sees. By doing what we do is part of the education process.
Exactly. It's training people on how to identify
exactly
what they're seeing.
Yeah.
It's like an incident that happened here in the Phoenix area recently. There was a report of a object that had two fixed lights on each end, and flashing lights on the underside.
Mm-hmm.
And a few days later, after reading this report, my husband was at work and was talking with a coworker,
mm-hmm.
and the coworker was telling him about how he and his wife were traveling down the road and
mm-hmm.
saw an object that matched the description from the UFO report to a
yeah.
T, and it was coming towards them.
Mm-hmm.
His wife had a cell phone camera in her hand and was going to take a picture of it through the windshield, and when it got over them, lo and behold, it turned out to be an airplane with scrolling advertising on the underside of the wings.
That's exactly what was in my head. It was either an advertising plane or a blimp.
You know, and gosh, that's, I mean, how often do you see an airplane with scrolling, like a screen or whatever, on the underside of the wings for advertising at night?
Exactly. I have, part of being an investigator is having your resources for research when you're doing investigations. Like on things like an ad plane or a blimp, one of my resources is the captain for the airship group that schedules all the launches for all of the airships in the country. So all I have to do is email him when I have a question if one of the blimps was up, and he gets back to me within a day.
Oh, gosh, that would be a good number to have handy, wouldn't it? for an investigator.
It is, yes.
Because, you know, one of the things that frustrates me, too, is with a lot of these photographs and videotapes, I mean, I don't know what these people are thinking, but a lot of times if you just look at it, you can tell that it's either a balloon or a group of balloons or just, gosh, a plastic bag floating around in the air.
Well, the thing also with that your balloon grouping thing that happened on that episode of UFOs over Earth, I think
yeah.
it was in Mexico.
Yeah.
Was it? We're getting accused of creating a hoax by sending up the balloons to see if the witness can recognize whether they're balloons or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's not creating a hoax. It's testing the witness's ability to differentiate.
Exactly, and I
pretty
agree
much
with
what
it.
It is. Well, we got people accusing MUFON of creating a hoax, which is ridiculous.
I read that too, and was going to comment on that. I you know, the people that were saying that you know, perpetrating a hoax on this individual, I didn't see it that way either. I agree with you. It was testing the individual's ability to discern balloons from an actual craft.
Well, and there are people out there, for some reason, God knows why, are trying to discredit MUFON. And the things that they're coming out with are absolutely not true. I was in the state director's meeting in Denver, and all these issues were addressed, and every one of the state directors came out of there with a clear knowledge of what was facts and what wasn't facts. And the things that these people are coming out with are not true.
I agree. And on that note, it's time for us to go to a break. And we'll be back in about 8 to 9 minutes here on Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
What's wrong with me? Why do I feel like this?
And welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis here on UFO Paranormal Radio Network, broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, Dee Andrew, and tonight we've been speaking with New England MUFON Director, Steve Fermani. Steve, you've been working diligently, along with Peter Robbins and a lot of other people, to put together a conference this coming September. They're in Exeter, New Hampshire. You want to give us a bit of taste of what will be going on?
Oh, yes. We've been working since the early months of this year to decide if there was even going to be another festival this year. And thanks to the hard work of so many people, Peter, Dean Merchant, Tim Bernal, who we're going to have as, I don't know if you're familiar with Tim, he's the host of Bernal of America.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Tim will be our MC at the festival, which I'm so happy about, because I met Tim last year at the Mass UFO show. In the Boston area, and I just thought he was a perfect fit for this. And we'll have myself, Peter. Peter will be giving two talks. Since the Dean, his health has not been so well lately, so Peter is gonna give Dean's talk on the 509th Bomber Wing, information about Exeter, New Hampshire, and Roswell, New Mexico connection. There will be an induction into the Exeter UFO Hall of Fame in the name of Norman Mosciarello. Will be accepted by Thomas Mosciarello and Thomas Mosciarello Jr. We have another speaker that's to be determined. We do know who it is, but I can't at this time reveal. It will be a well-known speaker. We just want to make sure that the information gets released by the Exeter Committee before we can release that information at that time. Stan Friedman will be here. I mean, you can't get much better than Stan.
Oh, he's the man.
He's the man. And to be able to see Peter speak twice, to see Stan, and it's free at the door. It doesn't get any better than that.
Oh, that's awesome. In most places, you know, to hear people of the stature that you just listed, it usually costs anywhere from $10 to $20 to $30
exactly.
Per person.
It's the type of thing that you can take your family to, and you don't have to spend a lot of money.
And there's also going to be quite a few other activities.
Yes, they have the buckets of chalk, like we talked about off the air, which is they supply chalk, and it's I know kids love to draw on the ground with chalk. And they can do their own little paintings and do whatever they want to do. There's going to be a setup of ET and UFO drawings throughout the town with chalk and other things. Beach rock painting at the Founders Park. So that there'll be painting, face painting, a story circle for children, and create a flying saucer. They'll have all kinds of materials out there. So you, the kids can go out there and just use their imagination and just build a flying saucer.
That sounds like so much fun.
Oh, it is. It will be.
Oh, and I was noticing that there's a costume contest. I think it's vintage 60s music at the Alien Cafe.
The Alien Cafe is it's a restaurant called the Loaf and Ladle. It's such a beautiful little quaint restaurant, and it's a typical New England pub eatery type of restaurant that I've had dinner there last year. And the clientele there are wonderful. Everyone there is just so wonderful. It's a really pleasurable place to visit.
The one that sounds like it'd be a lot of fun to me is the Downtown Alien Scavenger Hunt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's exactly what it is. Just like on Easter Sunday. They put out different things, and kids can go out and, people, given a list of things to look for, and the scavenger hunt. Go out there and find what you can find.
We've got a couple of questions from our virtual auditorium.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is from Cartoonist, and he asks, which New England state has had the most UFO reports?
That was from a cartoonist.
Also known as Dennis Reno.
That's who I thought it was. I knew Dennis was going to be listening.
I'll be here every Saturday.
Dennis is a fantastic caricature artist. Yes.
I've got the caricature that he did of me hanging on the wall right over my computer.
Yeah. Oh, he does. Have you ever been to his website?
Oh, isn't it? I love him. I just
Ufologist?
Love him. Yeah.
Ufologist is the name of his website. That's when I first met Dennis, because it was so humorous. I became friends with him on Facebook, and then he sent me a message on Facebook that said, "Hey, check this out." And I went to his website, and it had, I see this web page called The Ufologist, and it said, on the front page, it said, the newest ufologist, and it showed me there, with me sitting in the back of a flying saucer with an alien flying away. I was just laughing so hard. He does a fantastic job.
Okay, but back to his question. Which New England state has had the most UFO reports?
I think it's really close between Connecticut and Massachusetts. I think it's a draw between the two.
Okay. And Riccio asks, I'd like to hear what Steve thinks would be progress in ufology, disclosure aside, and whether he thinks that MUFON has contributed to ufological progress, and how.
MUFON contributes every year to ufology just by being there and just by receiving cases, analyzing cases, keeping cases on file, and educating the public. I think that's what we're here for, and I think that's what we do every year to contribute. We are trying to be more open to the public, and I think that will be a big contribution in the future.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Here's one from New York Lily. She asks, Do you get many reports of abductions, and what does New England MUFON have in place to handle them?
Well, New England MUFON, we are working on some abduction cases. What we do, I have one of my investigators in Massachusetts is a retired social worker. So what we do, her name is Iowata Schneider. She's one of my most trusted investigators. Her husband Norman is both of them as a team are probably two of my best investigators in Massachusetts and in all of the state. Iowata, as a retired social worker, I asked her to first contact any possible abduction witnesses and interview them and see what she feels. I really trust her opinion, and we can always fall back on contacting Kathy Martin when we do. So we have a good basis for starting or analyzing abduction reports, the possible abduction reports that come in, and you kind of have to take in those situations each case on its own merits. So each case is a different entity, so to speak, in itself.
Definitely. Here's a good one from my husband, actually, which I thought was a good one, and I'm kind of like wondering why I didn't come up with it. He asks, have you investigated any USO reports near the coastline in New England?
That one I can honestly answer you no. I have not received any USO reports. I've received one within the past few years that was a report off the coast of the United States, and the person felt that they were closer to the northeast than any other part where they had a sighting over the water while in an airliner. But that's about it.
Oh, those are always interesting.
Mm-hmm.
One scene from the air. I have another one here from Eternal Being, and he asks, does MUFON have a goal relative to dealing with the substance of the report, like itemizing and evaluating all relative similarities to give some substance to them that can be used to find answers to why and where and purpose of their presence here?
Well, that's a difficult question because, I mean, we take cases, we can group cases together, we can analyze different types of cases where it's a triangle sighting. We can already do that on our case management system. Now, will it get even better? We have a new case management system coming called CMS2. So it's yet to be seen on what the functions of CMS2 are going to bring us.
Good answer. Really good answer. I like that one. You're kind of getting back to the Exeter conference and festival.
Yes.
Okay. There's not everybody has read Incident at Exeter. I have a copy of it here on my desk, but if you kind of like give a little bit of a background on what happened.
I can give that. It's, I can't give you exact dates or anything, but it was back in probably between the late 60s and the early 70s. There was a soldier, I think he was in the Navy, his name was Norman Mosciarello, he was returning home one evening, and was on a pretty quiet, secluded road, and he witnessed an object came out of the sky. Looked like to be a bright light, turned into a bright beam of light, and an object that lit up the sky and lit up the houses around him, and approached him so close that he needed to duck into a gully on the side of the road to as if he was afraid that it was coming too close to him. After this incident, Norman frantically went to the Exeter police station, where there were the police officers initially met his story with skepticism. So what happened was, one of the officers went back to the location with him, and while in contact with another patrol car, both police officers in both cars, the other patrol car was in another area of the town, both viewed the same object. And both the officer and Norman witnessed the object there in that same spot. So it's a very well documented case through police reports and witness testimony.
I agree. If I remember correctly, this happened in 1965.
Yes. I knew it was like within the mid to late 60s to early 70s.
And if I remember right, he was 18, 19, and was just getting ready to go into the Navy.
Yes, he was just a young man.
And I wasn't sure whether he was still with us or not, but since his son is going to be doing the honors, so to speak, for the award, mm-hmm. I'm assuming he is no longer with us?
Yes, Norman had passed away. I'm not sure when, but yes, he is no longer with us, unfortunately.
Gosh, and all these historic cases, I mean, these very well-known historic cases, gosh, it's getting to where very few of the original participants, I guess you could call them, are still with us, and it's really kind of sad that well, to quote Stan Friedman, we're in a race with the Undertaker with a lot of individuals.
Oh, exactly, yep. And with Betty Hill and Bonnie Hill, both deceased, it's so nice to have Kathy Martin, who can relate a lot of this information to everyone.
I'm not all that familiar with New Hampshire. How far away is Exeter from, I believe the name of the area was Indian Head, where Betty and Barney Hill had their encounter?
I'm in Massachusetts, so as far as I couldn't give you exact information on that. I've never really measured the time and the distance from Indian Head, but it is a considerable distance. I hesitate to try and estimate something when I really don't know.
Oh, well, Cartoonist, I guess, just answered it here for us. Thank you, Cartoonist. He says, Indian Head is in central New Hampshire, and Exeter is in the southwest.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Cartoonist. Appreciate that.
Thank you. That helps me out a lot, too.
You know, with the conference going in Exeter, what are the long-term goals for the festival? Is this something that's going to be continued for years to come, or is this just...
We're hoping, myself, Peter, Tim Bernal, Dean Merchant, the Exeter Committee, we're hoping to make this a success. And if we can make this a success this year, it may push us on for another year. We would love to have this, to have such a good showing that it will help us to have one every year, to make it an annual event.
Okay, that, you hear that, everybody? Get your reservation set up now.
Exactly. We need you. We need people to come out there. We need people to support us. If you support us, we'll do it for you every year if we can.
And where else can you go and hear the likes of Stan Friedman and Peter Robbins and all the other speakers?
Exactly.
For free.
Exactly. You can't find it.
Other than, you know, on this program.
Well, you get them all, though, you know?
Well, I try.
You do.
So, what's in the future for yourself? Where do you see yourself in the next few years in your research?
Next few years. I'm trying to get through this year, but let me think. my future, I feel, is more of the same. I want to work hard to build New England MUFON. I want to make New England MUFON one of the strongest organizations within MUFON. I want to have the investigators I need. I want the membership I need. You can ask any one of our members. I do communicate with our membership. I set up anyone that joins the organization or is even interested in joining. I put them on my emailing list, and I send out regular emails to everyone.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. If anyone out there would like to be on my emailing list, just have them contact me, and I'll put them on there.
Speaking of websites, is there a website for the Exeter Festival?
UFOFestival.com.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. So everybody, go check out the website. Get your reservations and plan on seeing it.
And we have the New England MUFON website, www.newenglandmufon.com, which I think it's compared to a lot of other websites, I think it's pretty comprehensive, and it has things on there that people don't expect to see on there.
Well, and then not all MUFON states have a website, which I think is great that, you know, for those of you that do have websites, I think it's wonderful. My husband, David, sent a question from himself.
Mm-hmm.
He would like to know, have you had any cases that involve trace evidence being left behind? I know you already discussed the young couple in the car, but do you have any other cases?
Nothing other than the Baconia case, not within past memory. Those cases have an actual physical trace. That those cases are rare.
Few and far between.
Exactly. I was about to say the same words.
in all these cases, well, let me back up a little bit. About how many cases have you investigated?
Oh, my God. I've, since I started?
Yes.
Oh, my God. Maybe 500, 600.
Oh, my. And have you ever had one that just left you just scratching your head and laughing?
Yeah, well, but some of the cases, I had one, but I probably shouldn't really mention that. But there are some that leave, because I don't want to ridicule anyone, and I don't want to say anything about anyone or anything. But there are some that you get that do leave you scratching your head and say, you know, what was this person thinking?
and that's 500 cases. That's a lot. That's mind-boggling.
A lot of it is due to the fact that when I took over the six states, there was a lot of backlog on working on cases, and We had a backlog on a case management system, so I had to go through a lot of work and weed things out. Weed the wheat from the chaff and explain what I could and put investigators on what I couldn't. So a lot of that was involved in that process. So we have at this time, because I do need investigators, we have, I'd say, approximately 140 active cases that we either have investigators on or are waiting to put investigators on. So we need people. We need help. If people are interested, we're willing to train them.
A question just popped up in our virtual auditorium from Minister, and he's interested in any law enforcement police recordings of UFO sightings, like radio transmission recordings. Do you get any of those?
What was that again? A loud noise came by.
He's interested in law enforcement police recordings from their radio transmissions.
Oh, like from a scanner,
or the recordings from the police department, from their dispatch.
Almost zero. I think that we do get enough. It used to be before the everything was electronic, the case management system, and we were getting more cases. It would be something for an investigator to monitor, like police radios. Monitor for sightings, but I think that's pretty much obsolete right now because of we just get so many cases coming in without the need to do that, and I just don't think that it's really not worth it for the time spent listening. Because you really very seldom get anything out of it. I like listening to a scanner, so I do have a scanner on at my home, listening to police fire because I'm interested in that. But as a tool for gaining new sighting information, it's rarely used anymore.
Years ago, I had a police scanner, and I did get lucky enough to hear the talk of the dispatcher coming up saying, hey, we're getting a lot of calls, you know, what do you guys see, you know, from the county sheriff's department.
Yeah.
And the three officers that were on patrol that evening, all three saw this object. Mm-hmm. And after all three reported in what they were seeing to the dispatcher, it went quiet. Not another thing was said. And I just kind of kicked myself for not going to the dispatch office and say, hey, you know, who are the three officers involved? Would I be able to speak to them? You know, that kind of thing. But I didn't.
Actually, the best way to approach something like that would be to what I did before I went to Laconia. On that case, I emailed the police chief, and he was very cooperative and told me to stop in, and he didn't know much about it, and he would be out of town that day, but he gave me the name of a certain sergeant, and I went there, and I went into Laconia Police. They were completely cooperative, very nice. They took my business cards. They agreed that we could help them out in situations like that, where, you know, they're busy enough as it is, without having to take UFO reports and stuff, and they would refer that stuff to us. And within 5 minutes, I had a copy of the police report, and I was out of there.
Oh, wow. Well, at the time, I wasn't associated with any group or organization. It would have been just me,
uh-huh.
You know, but I never did. It, like I said, I was living in Idaho at the time, and it was a real small town.
Yeah.
You know, and where everybody knows everybody kind of town.
Well, and it all depends on the police department, too. I just happened to hit it lucky with Laconia that they were that cooperative, too. Not all of that cooperative.
We have another question from our virtual auditorium. This is from Eagle with Crown, and they ask, since there have been sightings of the lake monster Champy in Lake Champlain, Vermont, New York border, have there been reports at all of UFO sightings in that vicinity as well?
Oh, that's in the New York area, right? Nothing. I've received within the past year sporadic reports of UFO sightings, but nothing major. I think most of them that I've handled could have been explained as astronomical or man-made.
Well, you know, as you were saying, you've been able to explain some sightings.
Mm-hmm.
Roughly, what can the percentage that you have been able to find a logical explanation for?
It's historically, and I think it just remains the same historically. That I would say 85 to 90% can be explained as something man-made or astronomical or weather related. There were so many different phenomena in the skies that we don't know about. But it's the 10 or 15% that we cannot explain after rigorously ruling everything else out of the ones that stick, of the ones that stand.
So 10 to 15% come up as unexplainable.
Exactly. And that's historically, that's been that way since Project Blue Book.
I was just thinking the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking the exact same thing. I think Blue Book, I think at their highest was what, like 19%?
Although Blue Book even tried to explain away the ones they when they couldn't explain away, so I don't know if that really counts, you know.
Well, and then they would stick in some of the stupidest explanations as well.
Yeah, swamp gas.
Swamp gas.
I saw the funniest cartoon one time a friend had sent me. It was a comic. And it showed this. A bunch of natives out on an island, and they're pointing up at this UFO in the sky, and the chief is turned around with his back to them, got his arms crossed, and says, swamp gas. And I thought that was one of the funniest UFO cartoons I've ever seen in my life. So.
Oh, God. Yeah, I think I've seen that one. Come to think of it.
Yeah, I had a copy of that. I don't even know what ever happened to it. Fell in my file someplace. So.
Oh, let's see. We've got, oh gosh, this has been going fast. We've got 1 minute left.
Wow.
Is there, oh shoot, I'll do this really quick. David, just. Oh, excuse me. Oh, thank you, David. I'm looking at my clock wrong. We've got about 10 minutes left. And David just sent me another question, which I think is really, really interesting. He asks, are you aware of any ancient places, such as sacred Indian sites, old monoliths, etc., in New England, that have repeating UFO activity?
I don't know myself offhand of anything in New England, but Mark D'Antonio, for his talk at in Denver, did a very interesting talk on petroglyphs and the explanations of what a lot of the petroglyphs around in the world might be. Did a fantastic talk on that. I never knew that much about the subject. But it was a very interesting talk. Very informative. Yes, yeah.
Then we need to get him down here because they're all over the place around here.
Yeah, well, Mark's a great guy. Mark has a lot of talents.
gosh, there's Hedgepath Hills, which is only about 6 miles from our apartment. There's thousands of them on these volcanic boulders, and gosh, there's some on South Mountain. They're all over the area around here. How to get him down here? Interesting.
Yeah, that would be an idea. I think he'd love to see it.
You know, in all these cases that you've done and looked into, and gosh, you've been a very busy individual since you took over the regional director, state. How would you put your title? Still as state director, but state director for 6 states?
I'm director for New England MUFON. It's one organization now, New England MUFON.
Okay, I gotcha.
All 6 states are encompassed under the title New England MUFON.
That's a big area.
Well, you have people in Texas that are running the state of Texas, too, so that's a big area, too. So it's not much more of a challenge than what they do there.
Oh, here's a good question from Riccio again. He asks, a history question. Did the Hudson River and Connecticut sightings end completely 25 years ago, or have there been similar sightings since in New England?
Oh, the Hudson River valleys, and I think the Connecticut was nothing since then. Nothing since those sightings. No, there haven't been anything. As a matter of fact, you were talking about the Hudson River sightings. That brought something to mind, if I can find it right here and bring it up quick.
This here says mostly Danbury area.
Yeah. Cause I'm talking about Philip and Bruno, who was involved in the Hudson River Valley.
Oh, Phil and Bruno, yes.
Phil and Bruno, he will be speaking. I'll try and get you that information. But he will be speaking at a New England MUFON Connecticut meeting in September. I think it's in September or October. I'll try and get you that information.
Oh, here's another good question. This one's from Gossamer. He asks, have you ever interviewed any civilian pilots about any sightings or military people?
I've actually interviewed a civilian pilot in right in my hometown. We have a local airport in our area. He saw something that looked like it was floating, but it didn't look like a balloon. It looked like an object, more of a metallic type of thing. This was witnessed by an experienced pilot.
Oh, interesting. I love pilot cases.
Oh, yes, it's so credible. The credibility is, you know, it's if they're flying and they're experienced in flying, I mean, their ability to perceive things is important to their well-being as a pilot.
With that pilot, did he by chance contact any airport radar systems to see if they could pick up this object?
No, because this is just a local small airport. So, but actually, this is the odd part. I got this mixed up a little bit because he is an experienced pilot, but what he witnessed didn't happen while he was flying. He was driving.
Okay.
He was driving at the time. So, a pilot is a witness is a pilot is a witness.
Exactly, because a pilot of all people would be able to tell the difference between a conventional aircraft and something that obviously isn't.
Now they should be able to.
If they can't, they shouldn't be flying.
Exactly. Well, it's kind of funny though, because when I was first learning about astronomical aspects, I learned that actually a professional airport control tower operator had actually at one time cleared the planet Venus for landing. So that shows you how confusing it can be when a professional like that can make a mistake.
Oh, my. Cleared Venus to land. Okay. Well, there has been a few times when I've seen Venus that it looked like a landing light.
It can look so bright. And a lot of people don't realize that it can also be seen in daylight as a morning star. It's what they call it. It can be an evening star and a morning star. And it can be seen in the morning when the sky is brighter.
Exactly. Oh, let's see. We've got 3 minutes to go. Is there anything that you would like to say to our listeners and websites that you'd like them to go to?
I'd like to say Exeter Festival, September 4th, Exeter, New Hampshire. We'd like your support. We'd like you all to come here. Website, our website, New England MUFON, www.newenglandmufon.com. We need people to help. We need members. We need investigators all over New England. We would love to have you on board.
And the website for the festival?
The website for the festival is exeterfestival.com.
Fantastic. Let's see. You've got 2 minutes left. Let's see. Have you ever had a sighting of your own?
Yes, I did, but it's nothing fantastic. I was out camping. I was looking up at the stars, and I saw what looked to be a satellite. I'm watching because I love space. I love watching the stars, and I just laid back and I was looking up there, and all of a sudden, it looked like a satellite just took off and went zip, 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 back and forth in a couple of directions, and just zipped off into the stars. And I don't know what could have possibly caused that. So
wow.
When I hear people, when people report something like that to me, now I know. I said, I was not seeing things. This was it. This is what the thing did.
Just one last quick question here.
Mm-hmm.
From Gossamer, he asked, what do you have planned for New England MUFON? Do you have any goals that you would like to set and try to meet?
my goal is to, instead of having, as other MUFON organizations have had, state section directors, I would like to have no borders between the New England states. I would like to create a network of zone directors within the New England states. And once I can get someone trusted in each of these areas, we will be able to run meetings in each zone and generate membership and investigators and have a functional organization throughout New England.
Sounds like really good goals.
I'm trying.
And unfortunately, we are now all out of time.
Well, it was quick.
2 hours do seem to fly.
Yes, it does.
And thank you so much for being with us tonight. I really enjoyed this.
I really appreciate it, too. I really appreciate your time, and I love being here.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Well, that's all the time we have for tonight. I want to thank everyone for tuning in and also thank all those who joined us in the Pal Talk Auditorium. Great bunch of questions tonight, guys. Thank you very much. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Our guest this evening is Benjamin Cream. Please join us again next Saturday for Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone.